2006, June the 29th, and we are visiting with Kermit Oliver. Kermit, tell us how you came to Houston, Texas, when you came to Houston, Texas, and what was the city like when you arrived?
Well, it's very difficult because I had just graduated from high school, and I had two brothers already here in college at Texas Southern. And that was the summer of 1960. I had just turned 17. And a friend of my brother's, Cecil Taylor, he had encouraged me to come and major in art. I thought I would do it in literature. But he took me to the murals and the administration buildings, and we finally went over to the science building, and I saw Dr. Billy's mural. Really, it was like Adam and Eve, but it was I can't think of the name of the mural, but that convinced me that, yes, I would become an art student.
So, Kermit, you decided instead of pursuing words, you were going to pick up the brush. What happened?
Well, that is about the beginning of a long career of trying to graduate. My first semester I completed, but I didn't have the money for the second semester, and Dr. Biggers got me a Jesse Jones scholarship, and so that started off the long travail of trying to graduate, which having a family, I got married. I met Kate in 62, no, it was the fall of 61, and we were married in fall of 62, and then I think it took me until 1967 to graduate. And but the experience was one of a sort of a religious experience that's the way Dr. Biggers established the environment at Texas Southern. And we were there to expose ourselves to educating young black students, rather, because, again, integration was not a really extensive experience in Houston. And so we were very isolated in that context. And the mural painting was one of the larger emphases that, as a graduating senior, you were responsible for doing, so that was something we looked forward to. And we were versed in African lore and some African history, but it was not an area which I wanted to concentrate on, because from my background I did not have the associations with African
sure.
culture, and so that put me at odds with the art environment there, that almost to the point of being persona non grata, because my work was not concentrating other than the black American ethos in the rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
And being in the urban area, most of the themes were dealt with the urban and black, and then the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement became prominent, and so I was never considered black enough in the work that I was doing or the motifs that I was working with.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kermit, how did you, what inside you do you think drew you in the direction for your subjects and the allegory and the spiritual elements and essence in your work? When did that surface inside your head? That while you were at TSU, that you began to respond to that, to define what you were going to address and what you were going to create and paint?
Well, actually, my remaining 2 years in high school really coalesced my idea of the literary, the narrative aspect of art. And my high school teachers, a Mrs. Kirchie and a Mrs. McMichael, had always encouraged me to think in terms of my art from a narrative standpoint. And I hadn't really seriously considered majoring in art, but it was when you were given questions about what were you going to do, well, that would be likely the obvious thing, because I did more of it. Then my senior year, I'm not my senior, but my sophomore, the second year, second semester in college, I, being out and idle, I spent the semester in the library, and I just went through all of the encyclopedias on art and all of the research books that I can manage each day. And it gave me sort of a basis of the continuity of art history. And then the following semester, when we had to first approach art history as a requirement, it stimulated all of the understandings that I had of myself and what I had wanted to do with my art. And it was very difficult for me to distinguish between the two elements of visual expression and the narrative for a point of view. And it was part of my upbringing, and we were rich in oral traditions and storytelling. But as I got into college, a larger picture of man's inhumanity, man, or his relationship with his fellow man, and all of the religious context that was involved. And then I came across mythology, and I think it's in 64 was really when I started concentrating on the idea of the parallel religion, religion in terms of comparative religion, mythology, legends, and in my own background.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was the leading motif that formulated my work, and it also separated me from trying to be a dark mirror to what the heavy influence Dr. Biggs's experience in Africa had brought into the department. And so it was alien to me in terms of my how I was cultivated, how I was nurtured. And even though there were some aspects of it that was universal, but to put it in the context of the African genre, Dr. Biggs had said all that could have been said. Anything else would have been a very poor exam.
Well, it says you mentioned that you had a semester where you were idle, but then I don't think you were idle from it. You got into all those books and you did all that reading and you began to figure out, so this is how art history, this is a history of all these kinds of things and how one came. In a way, you know, it was a gift to you to have that time where you could really, you might not have thought it was at the time, but looking back, I would think it would be like a gift to have the time to begin to turn those pages and open those thoughts in your own mind. So tell the, your work has always been figurative, is that right? And I remember some of your, did you have a drawing instructor that was particularly important to you?
Yes, that was, Junkin was his last name. He was a exchange instructor with Dr. Biggs, who, University of Wisconsin. And he had noticed some, what he felt was inherent compositional advantages that I had acquired through observing illustrations from art history. And I had, within a year, I think a year later, I came across a book, Painter's Secret Geometry by Charles Boileau, and right away I saw what he was speaking to in terms of the compositional aspect of the picture plane and the geometries that were involved in that and how it informed European training. Well, going all the way back to European training, it had informed art history since the beginning of formalized images and structures. And so that was another very important period of my life that I started intently using geometric schemes, musical ratios and geometric schemes, as opposed to the golden ratio, the golden mean that was supposed to be prevalent aspect of Renaissance art. But getting into the Baroque area where they had use of dynamics and off-centered elements of composition where the musical ratios came into being, which I attached on readily. And then later on, I improvised and created, well, I won't say created, but I distorted the formal elements into something that was more pertinent to what I was doing in terms of the dimensions I was using, in terms of the configuration that I had to deal with. But most people think in terms of me using the golden ratio, which is more static than the dynamic ratios, which is based on musical musical themes, musical modes at the time.
Kermit, did you discover that musical ratio, or did he teach you that, or did he just recognize that in your work?
He just recognized the dynamic geometry that was in my work, and which was by intuition that I was applying. And it was only a year later or so that I came across this book by accident, and I saw that you can purposefully do this. And so I was always wondering, the works that I had liked was the works that were more closer to those formalized presentations.
That must have been a real aha experience for you when you have this intuitive sense of things, and all of a sudden you open a book and you find yourself and your whole, you know, your sense of perception is put out in front of you. It's a miracle. It's a miracle.
It was. It was one of those epiphanies, you know, that you have. We went to Westboro Square quite often, and there was a bookstore. There was two books that were out of place, the Painistic Geometry and Jung's Symbol of Transformation. And those two books were really been prominent in the formulation of mine, mm-hmm. and they happened on the same night.
The stars, I think, were just right for you that night.
They
it
were.
Was all lined up.
They were.
Well, now, Kermit, on the stories and the symbols and that you use, and you do have recurrent symbols, I think, in your work, that over a period of time people can see them surfacing here and there. Do you want to talk about any of those particular symbols that you seem to incorporate over and over that are important to you for some reason?
Actually, the overview of my work deals with the metamorphosis of ideas, as well as objects, the idea of birth, death, rebirth, or resurrection. And those themes, those objects I use really reflect it from the standpoint of my religious upbringing. The symbolism and the literature that deals with Christ, the Christ figure. And then when in my reading of art history and the themes that were used, and you come across other figures that deal with the idea of vegetation god, like Attis, Adonis, Mithras, the Egyptian god Osiris. They all have this parallel aspect of the sacrifice of the demigod or the god, or the god incarnate that brings about salvation for humanity, and then he's resurrected, and then it sets a model for persons themselves within their daily life, in which there's this constant redemption that's involved in their sacrifice of self and how this brings about a rebirth. And so basically that was, I was looking at themes that dealt with the idea of immortality, the transitoriness of life, the idea of growth, and the butterfly is one of the idea of the cocoon, which is death. The butterfly is an adult that is that lays the egg. The worm or the caterpillar is preparing itself through life. I mean, all of those, the fish, all these images are images that associate with figures that dealt with the invitation or the event, or the advent of a god that sacrifices his godliness to bring about salvation to humanity. And its idea for a rebirth, which is the that deals with sin, redemption.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically.
So let's go back a little bit in your history. Tell us where you were born and how you came to, before you came to TSU, how you came to a sense that you might have this, an artist in you.
I was born in Refugio, Texas, R-E-F-U-G-I-O. Okay. Many people pronounce it Refugio. But if you're from Texas, and you can tell if they pronounce it Refugio, you know that's what it is. It's a very rural area, ranching and oil and art person that needed to have a way to express himself. And I did it with art, with drawing, but it was nothing unusual. It was nothing thought of being unusual. Other people would think, oh, well.
Kermit's picked up a pencil and
he's
going to draw.
Yes, but it was a way that most of the school kids would do. I mean, we
mm-hmm.
would do things like that. And
mm-hmm.
We would place more emphasis on who could handwrite better or who could print better or whatever than to who could draw this better. But as time went on and people recognized that there was some little talent or something there, you start nurturing that because it gave you a way of a certain amount of status. And if someone wanted something drawn, they said, what permit would you do this, do this, do this? So, and it allowed me to participate because I was very shy and without having to communicate that much.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really the context in which my art dealt with. I would illustrate some cartoons for the high school newspaper that my brother, before I went to high school, I was in about the seventh grade then. I think the first time that I really seriously thought of art as something I was able to command was in about the seventh grade. I did a cycle of St. George and the Dragon. We were illustrating some of the stories in the books that we had. And
those are fun. Where are those drawings?
Oh, well, it was on brown paper, unrolled. Oh, no. No. And then when I got to high school, there was an English teacher there that had encouraged me to illustrate my papers, and then she had a series of favorite authors that she wanted me to do portraits of, and that's why I was saying that I was always this continuity of this parallel track of narrative and visual art. And I was the assistant art editor of the newspaper, the high school newspaper, and I was the art editor of the annual. But it was, again, there was almost like a pro forma, you know,
mm-hmm.
And that's why my decision to become an art major did not become a decision until after I got on college campus.
How did you end up coming to TSU? Were you recruited, or did you hear about it? Or?
Well, I had two brothers. I had a brother that was in draft school. That's why I had a cousin that had graduated from Texas Southern Art, Lavernus Royal, and he had done a lot of illustrations in the church there with the quotations and things. So I mean, there it was a lot of influences there. There was an old man who was, we always called magician with things. He was an artist. He did signs there, but he would make things. And so, I mean, it was an environment that nurtured the idea if you had a talent, you know, you had something different to set aside that you were supposed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not something that was exceptional. And I was never an exceptional artist. Even when I got to college, we had people that make us feel very embarrassed. I mean, I struggled. My work is a long, long struggle.
Were you struggling because of the subject matter?
No. I mean, skill. I mean,
yeah.
It was just you were dealing with larger purposes,
mm-hmm.
and you thought of, you had a larger responsibility. And talent was, to me, was a mechanical thing that was learned in my personal experience. But you had students that were just, it was embarrassing. I would bring a work in, and you said Henry Smith and Henry Wilson, and he would have brought the work in, and I'd have to go. I would be almost to tears, you know. So I'd go. We had this company. It was a highly competitive thing because it was ideas. I wish I had done that. But people were so different. I mean, we were struggling to get up under Dr. Bigger's influence with his African experience.
Could you repeat that? You were struggling about what was Dr. Bigger's?
Well, Dr. Bigger's had his reputation and his status in the art community was built upon his 58 trip. I mean, it was overwhelming. Mm-hmm. We saw him work. We saw the results of the work. I mean, the drawing especially. I mean, it was just depressing to see things like that, and you're not able to do them. So that was one of the influences also to say that I had to deal with something that was more innate in terms of the narrative aspect, that was more universal in the culture that I grew up under and I existed in, rather than trying. I saw some works by non-black artists that would challenge the visual aspect, the surface aspect of Dr. Bigger's work, but there was something in the work that was a spiritual aspect that mm-hmm. was there that you didn't, you couldn't find
in the other work.
So I was not old enough to have had the connection he had with the old African American experience and the tie that still brought some of the African experience in.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, it would be a surface aspect of me to just deal with the image of African art in what Dr. Bigger was doing. There were some stories in his childhood that he could relate to when he went back to Africa and heard. I couldn't. It was a matter of intellectual honesty as well as cultural honesty that I could not. I never felt comfortable, and I never did. I don't think that I ever did an African theme. I never did. I was angry that he did not ask me to paint his shells in his mural. That he had asked Henry Wilson to paint, but Henry Wilson painted shells all the time. But I thought that I was the one that should have been. But this is where it was, you know, this is so, and again, to establish an identity,
mm-hmm.
Or to express who I was. And this is what art was supposed to have been about, and this is what we were taught in our art education curricula, that this is what we were there for, to let a child express himself. We were there as mentors, well, not so much prophets and mentors, to go out into the wilderness with the school children and give them a means of expressing themselves. And this was the philosophy of art education.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it was a very awkward experience. Especially, were very isolated from the general direction the art department was mm-hmm. taking, and their antagonism, not only solidified where I was going, but it also had a tendency to narrow the channels in which I could express certain things. And painful experience, not only dealing with my own mediocre talent, and I have that's the way I'm always chided with. Friends that say that I'm the only one that trying to defend the value and the worth of mediocrity, and I came back to them again. If you would understand how I merited a museum show, that would show you that people should be encouraged. Mediocrity is not too bad.
Well, I wouldn't say mediocrity is the right word, but you know, it's interesting when you think about being a young person, and we're young, and it's remarkable, I think, when a young person can first of all identify an inner voice or an inner predisposition, and after knowing they have, can sense it and know there's something different there, to have the wherewithal and the strength to honor that versus trying to be pulled into a direction that just really is intrinsically dishonest for that particular person. And I think that's what you're talking about that happened to you. And from my perspective, it's commendable that you had sort of an inner sense of self, and then having had that, that you had the strength and the ability to step back and say, I've got to be the person that I am. A lesson for all of us. Carmen, on another note, coming in the early 60s for school, and you and Katie getting married, tell us about how you found the art scene in Houston and how you all took that in.
Well, when I would come go to work, I rode a bicycle several miles to Framing Shop, and there were a lot of galleries in Westheimer that I would stop and look at, but the one before that, I think it was Robinson Gallery.
What other galleries did you go to?
The Robinson,
David,
and Mary Long, and DuBose, and I think those, and then each week I would make one trip to the museum after 70, right at 70 when we moved, but a few, but gallery going between, I guess, 60 and 65, which it was on the street that we passed.
Going and look.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a different experience because everyone was doing art, it seemed. I mean, in the Art League of Houston, I would always go there. And they were at another location, I think it was on South Main, mm-hmm. near the old Contemporary Arts Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And we even sponsored a Texas University College show there, at the old Art League. But that was it. I mean, I was always looking, you know, and the University of St. Thomas, the gallery, I would go over there. You know.
Mm-hmm. What was that gallery like?
The most impressive, it was small. They had a lot of lectures. I think the last time I went, we went with Mr. Junkin. They had a show that were reproductions of the main one was the Entombment of Christ. It was by Canaletto,
mm-hmm.
and it was a large painting. And that was really one I had. It was the lecture was dealing with that period, the Baroque period. It had a lot of some cop studio from Canaletto, and it was a small thing, but the lecture series. And then they had Rice, DeMille had her gallery there. We would go there to shows. And, mm-hmm. I can't think of many something that you wonder, oh, well, I can't do that. I see it. But that was the whole thing. It was like being inspired or motivated because there was very few, we were very isolated and very reclusive. And so, but we could go into those places in an anonymous situation. And we started showing there. We had to go there once a month. We would stand out for about an hour before we were dragged into the gallery, but that was our only social hour.
Well, tell me, how did Ben DuBose come to represent your work?
I had been shown with Diane Smith, and Bill Hill and Diane Smith had come over. He had brought him over to the Art Center and had inquired about. He had at that time promoted my name around, and I don't know how that got started, except he had come over and looked around at the work. And Eleanor Freed was a very important promoter of my work. She was interested in I think a year I was at Guy Smith and had a one-man show, and then Dr. Biggers, he had inquired him first, and Doc was not interested in showing in topic at the department, going to commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And so he also had recommended that he could inquire. So that's, I went in, and Ben DuBose asked me to if I would be interested.
What year was that?
That was 69, because my first show there was 70, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And
tell me about Ben DuBose as a person.
He was seemed to be a person that was a value in collecting, like child collectors. That was what would make the community, the art community grow. As you began young collectors with young artists and then let them grow. Some of them recognized as some of the leading artists that were in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the compliment that I had. And there was also the intimidating aspect of being in that interval gallery. As I said, it was discouraged, you know.
Was it discouraged in school to show your work commercially?
Yes.
Why?
We were there to become art educators. And it was a version of the philosophy of the school. And, you know, Dr. Biggs didn't sell. He very rarely sold. He refused to sell his work from that standpoint.
How did Eleanor Fried find your work? Did she visit the campus, or how did she come
in? Yes. Matter of fact, when they had the dedication of the new building in 64, that's really what helped me in the art community. That she was a friend of the department in the school, and that she always promoted and wrote articles on the school. And that's what happened. And so she, when I got it,
be supportive. How do you remember Houston as a city? You came in the early 60s, basically, 60s moving into the 70s. I mean, what did Houston feel like? What kind of a place was it?
When you isolate yourself, I mean, you're in a very small environment.
Mm-hmm.
So it was exciting because you were seeing things that you could see what was beginning. In terms of where the gallery was going, there was a vitality, I think, if anything.
Mm-hmm.
And you were there, part of it, but it was you were not part of it. We were outside of that, but
mm-hmm.
we were observers.
Mm-hmm.
And to see going from Westboro Square, which was the exciting thing for us, that was what we do once a week, and then the Galleria opens up.
Kurt, you know, talking about the designers made my mind shift to tell us how did your relationship with Aramis come about? That's an unusual for an artist in the United States, not counting in the city of Houston, Texas.
That was through Lawrence Marcus. He had Katie downtown in Houston. A gallery, and she and her friend, they were interested in having a show. They'd come to the house and saw a headboard that I had made, and he liked the bottom. Well, that reminds me of Hermes might be interested. I think about, I didn't know anything about Hermes. Katie did.
Kermit, tell us about how you came to move from Houston, and you're now living in Waco. And so how did all that come about?
You know, that was Katie's grandmother had passed, and he wanted to move there. And it was nothing. I had lost interest in the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
Working there, so we were able to get up there via transfer. Post office that I was working in, and I was losing interest early on, and so we moved to Waco for that reason. And
mm-hmm.
I think it was a long besiegement, and I think out of exhaustion and the inability to say no over a length of time, that the same conditions that whatever I do, and there was no removing.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kermit, is there anything that you would want to in reflecting on where you are right now and your path coming through so far, to share with younger people, younger artists that are beginning their path or midway in their path? Do you have any thoughts along that line?
Well, I think persistence doesn't grow out of their own character and sense of purpose, then it won't. Art is something that you do, and it's nothing that is done for a purpose beyond you. Don't be afraid to be mediocre.